Well, folks, if you're turning into What a Week, we're doing something different today. But for What a Week listeners, before we get into what we're doing today, I know that this particular KSQD show is being listened to by a fair amount of people overseas, and I want to address the latest shooting just happened of another Minnesota resident, pretty much a cold-blooded execution, the way any way you look at it, that just happened in the streets of Minneapolis at the hands of America's most hated amateur fascist police force. So for you folks overseas, I'm not going to say that this isn't who we are, because tragically, this is who some of us are. And any listener of What a Week knows that we're in for a very, very long haul here. But I also want to remind you, dear listeners, that wherever you are, there is another America. And that America, ironically, is represented by another resident of Minnesota that pretty much embodies what our country is capable of in all its ragged glory. This guy once said, "There's no right wing, there's no left wing, there's only an up and down wing, and down is pretty close to the ground." And lately, we've all been pretty close to the ground with everything that's been going on, so I'm hoping that this next 3 hours can lift everyone up a little bit. Just checking in, Sean Willits, are you there?
I certainly am.
Good. Sean's here, and I just have one key question here. Is it rolling, Bob?
Well, I'm just one of them rambling boys, rambling around and making noise. Sometimes lonely, sometimes blue. No one knows it better than you. Rambling round, rambling twirl, rambling down through the world. Rambling down, rambling twirl, rambling down through the world.
Pee-popping magnificence, Bob Dylan, Town Hall, April 12th of 1963, and also demonstrating that tonal breath control where he once claimed he could sing twice as long as Caruso, and you know what? He was right. Sean, before I dive deep into this three-hour musing conversation, I want to kind of tell everybody who you are and what you're about, and this is the most dumb way to do it. It's basically just go to Wikipedia, because as we all know, the internet never lies, right? So correct me if I get any of this wrong. Sean Willits is an American historian who serves as the George Henry Davis Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. Research include U.S. social, civic, and political history in the 19th and 20th centuries. He's written several award-winning books and articles, including The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, which is awarded the Bancroft Prize and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for History. He's also written for The New Yorker, New York Review of Books, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, The Atlantic, London Review of Books, The American Scholar, The Nation, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel, and is now on KSQD. So you've taken a giant step up here in media, Sean, I just have to tell you. But what brings us to you today is that you are not just a rabid fan of Bob Dylan, you're a definitive scholar in my ever humble opinion. And your book, Bob Dylan in America, well, I'm going to name check that book many times across this next 3 hours, is if you have to read one Dylan book, read that one. It's a fantastic book. And as only a his history professor Cadu also loves Bob Dylan. Most importantly, Sean wrote the album notes for the 8-CD collection Through the Open Window, which is pretty much documents Bob from 1956 to 1963. So this is the period when Bob Dylan is becoming Bob Dylan. And this is a chronological look at from the very first things he was doing all the way through 1963. And this 3 hours is going to be divided into three parts, 3 hours. First hour pretty much centering in 1961, second hour 1962, and third part in 1963. So we're going to start really early, and this box set starts about as early as you can get. The Terlinda Music Shop in St. Paul, Minnesota. So here's a scrap of Bob Dylan, 15-year-old Bob Dylan, and he's playing with his buddies, and they pay $5 and make a record. So you talk about proto-Bob Dylan, it doesn't get much better than this. So that is about as early and crude as it gets for Bob Dylan. And I hope you didn't object to my lengthy introduction there, torn from the pages of whatever it was torn from. So we just heard.
Well,
I don't know
you got all the stuff on Wikipedia. You got the stuff on Wikipedia that isn't incorrect. So that's great.
Oh, good. Is there? That's good confirmation. There is actually something on Wikipedia that is correct. That's good news. So
some of it.
We just played Let the Good Times Roll from 37 Slice of Music. What prompted you, what possessed you to put that 37 table scrap to open up this mammoth box set?
Well, the box set is going to show you, is intended to show you Bob Dylan's growth. You know, in effect, how Bob Dylan became Bob Dylan. And to tell that story, you really have to go back to the beginning. And, it was to capture something about the young then Bob Zimmerman, and what kind of music he was into. This is 1956, so he's 15 years old. And, that's what he was doing. And we can see right away he's into R&B, he's into doo-wop, he's into all that kind of stuff. There are no recordings of him with his bands in around 1958, 59, before he leaves for Minneapolis. But there is this tape, and this is actually the one you've heard, one you just played, is the very first known recording of Bob Dylan, although there's rumors that there's something about a bar mitzvah tape, which would have been when he was 13, but we have not yet seen that come to light. So that's why we did it. We wanted to have the earliest starting point we could, and this is it.
Well, we talked about the conception, the idea that this 56 to 63, and you are the official historian of the Bob Dylan official website. So you're a made guy in Dylanology, not just like me, a fanatic from afar, but you have a platinum Bob Dylan signed by Dylan's manager card here. And when you were spelunking,
I mean, basically, when Jeff Rosen and I were talking about this years ago, many years ago, I said, why don't I become your historian in residence? And he said, well, you know, Henry Steele Commager or Arthur Celeste, they're not angling for the job, so yeah, we'll give it to you.
And Jeff Rosen is Bob's long-suffering manager, in case people want to know. Jeff Rosen is all roads lead to Jeff Rosen, and I think the phrase long-suffering is somewhat appropriate too, because Bob, I think he's an unmanageable manager. Bob does what he wants to do when he wants to do it. But Jeff and he and Dylan have been together for years and years and years and years.
Yep.
How involved is Bob in the is what I would expect completely, just don't talk about this, I don't want to know anything you're doing, just do it? Or does Bob actually kibitz a little bit in your experience, certainly on this box set?
I haven't talked to him directly about it, but I don't really know the answer to your question, Eric. You know, I wish I did.
You're not telling me that something about Bob Dylan is mysterious. Come on, that flies against everything I know about the man.
Once Steve Berkowitz and I were given the assignment and given all of the music and all of that stuff, we did what we wanted. I mean, this is very much Steve and my, creation. We would talk to Jeff, obviously, because I talked to Jeff anyway. But this is really what Steve Berkowitz and I did. And if Bob likes it, that's great. And if Bob doesn't like it, it's too bad. But it's very much our baby.
Well, I'm going to go. Let's go to a bit of music here. We're going to jump from 1956. We're going to go through the legendary Golden Chords, which is the name of Dylan's rock band performance at the Hibbing Town Hall. And we're going to go to – he's now a folky. This would be the East Virginia Blues from Madison. Can you set this song up a little bit? Because this is proto-folky Bob, but it's definitely – you can see something is brewing up here in the guy.
Yeah. This was recorded in Madison, Wisconsin in late 1960. He was on his way to New York. He had already gotten as far as Chicago, but then he doubled back to Madison for reasons that are unknown. But he knocked on the door of actually a friend of mine, Ron Radosh, looking for a place to stay. He had gotten Ron's name from somebody, and Ron didn't have a place to stay, but he ended up with a man named Danny Kalb. And Danny Kalb's name may be familiar to some of your listeners. He was the guiding spirit, well, one of the guiding spirits behind a band called the Blues Project, which was kind of the great white R&B band, a blues band, apart from, the Butterfield Band, obviously. But at any rate, that would be years later. In 1960, he comes in there, and Danny Kalb is a great guitarist. Here's this young kid from Hibbing, Minnesota, who's headed to New York, where Danny Kalb was from. Danny Kalb had actually studied the guitar with a man named Dave Van Ronk in Greenwich Village. I don't think Bob knew much about what Danny had, but maybe he did. At any rate, the two of them sit down, and they sit down in front of a tape recorder, and they start playing. And the tape that survives, which is in extraordinarily good shape, shows both Bob Dylan showing what he could do, and then some cuts where Danny joins in and the two of them play together. This is East Virginia Blues, and this is Dylan by himself, and he's kind of showing off what he can do going through Madison, Wisconsin. And this is, an old folk song, and, let's listen to what he had to do.
I know some other stuff that isn't pretty good. I was born in East Virginia, North Carolina. Thank you.
Bob, you were never down south, you trickster, you.
He's already starting to embellish, shall we say, his biography.
Embellish? Yeah. That's a nice word for it. That's how the New York Times writes about Donald Trump. Embellish?
Yeah, right. Right. Well, let's not put Bob and Donald Trump
in the same sentence, please. Enough, please.
Exactly.
But what struck me listening to that is I brought up that Caruso line. You know, I can hold my breath twice as long as Caruso. Mm-hmm. You can already tell Bob's can hold notes, and that's it's his gimmick, you know. And I'm sort of struck by that by listening to this box set. And people just tuning in, this is Eric Nelson. We're doing a 3-hour live special with Sean Willance, official Bob Dylan historian. I think you can get away with saying that, who wrote the album notes for the 8-CD box set Through the Open Window, which pretty much chronicles how Bob Dylan became Bob Dylan. And we're going to retrace those footsteps in the next 3 hours. Wanted to get that in very quickly for people. Mm-hmm. But I won't call him a novelty act, but if you come at Bob Dylan through the prism of this cherubic 19-year-old, intensely charismatic little ragamuffin who combined the kind of humor and physical comedy of Charlie Chaplin with his preternatural ability to sound like a session, who could also hold notes and also play harmonica, one could say that, yeah, well, no wonder he became Bob Dylan. You know, he had a lot of – right out of the box, 19 years old, sleeping on someone's couch, he sounds like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's got the ability, especially on the harmonica, actually. I mean, where holding notes is a big deal, but you can hear on the singing as well. I mean, the guitar playing is not exactly, shall we say, up to snuff, but he's got a lot to learn, and he's going to be learning a lot. But as you say, Eric, he had a lot to work with from the very start. And this is as close as we can get to hearing these cuts, or as close as we get to hearing what Bob Dylan sounded like when he hit New York in January 1961. So, and there's another point to be made too, though. You know, people talk about Dylan as a Woody Guthrie jukebox. In fact, he's described himself as a Woody Guthrie jukebox. The reason he was going to New York was to meet his idol, Woody Guthrie. But he wasn't just singing Woody Guthrie songs. This has to do with his repertoire and his interests as much as anything else. He's already interested in a world of folk music that he's only fairly recently been introduced to, but he's taking it all in. And this is something that, again, is very typical, or is going to be a hallmark for Dylan right up to the present, and taking everything in and making of it his own. And then, of course, you know, the line at the end where he's talking about meeting some old guy down south. I mean, you know, you can't always trust what he has to say.
Yeah, I would say you can never trust what he has to say. So let's get him to New York now. We're going to go to the home of Bob and Sid Gleason. So if anyone has seen No Direction Home, the movie starring Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan, which I had did a 2-hour special on my thoughts on the movie, Further Deponent Saith Not, but they dramatized that where Bob gets out of the car, he's hitchhiking in, walks right into a club, meets Dave Van Ronk, and within, 5 hours, he's in East Orange visiting Woody Guthrie. Not quite how it happened, but he is now completely under Woody's thrall, and he's in Woody's backyard, and he is visiting Woody. So the Pastures of Plenty we're about to play, because you did a wonderful job sort of teeing this up. Where's Bob at? Where is he? What's he doing? And why is this significant?
Well, he's in East Orange, New Jersey, at the home, as you said, of Bob and Sid Gleason. They had actually arranged to get Guthrie. They were old fans of Guthrie's, and they had managed. Guthrie was hospitalized, very, very ill with Huntington's disease.
In East Orange, and is that where the asylum is?
In East Orange. Well, it was nearby. And they had a nice, modest little house, and but they loved Guthrie, and they wanted him to get him out of, you know, this facility, which was pretty dreary. And so they arranged with them to bring Guthrie to their house every Sunday. And or most Sundays. And what would happen is that all of his old friends from the village, well, from New York at any rate, Pete Seeger, people like that. Cisco Houston was there for a little while before he was ill too. But Cisco Houston, yeah, Jack Elliott, I mean, when he got back from England, lots of the old people would come to the Gleasons to, in effect, you know, have a another hootenanny, had to relive their youth in some ways, but also to give Guthrie, you know, to surround him with love, to surround him with family, to surround him with the people he knew, and to play music. Dylan gets word of this very early on. In the movie, he gets the address from Van Ronk. That's all crazy. But he gets word very early on, and he goes out to the Gleasons. And he's sort of a hit right away because – first of all, he adores Woody Guthrie. That's very clear. He knew lots of Woody's songs, which is also clear. But he, you know, he ingratiated himself with what was, in effect, a sort of sacred circle of the old, or not so sacred, that's the wrong word, but you know what I'm saying, a prize circle of the old Popular Front left-wing folk music people from as early as the 30s and 40s. He's there less than a week, and already he's hanging out with these people that were idols. But he shows the proper deference and so forth, but he's there and he's singing a lot of Woody Guthrie songs. He stays at the Gleasons actually for days at a time.
He's certainly an inveterate couch surfer. This is the couch surfing phase of Dylan's career.
Absolutely. For the next year or so. He doesn't get an apartment for a while. But he's there, and one day he sings a bunch of things, and one of the things that he sings is Pastures of Plenty.
It's a mighty rough road my poor hands have hold. My poor feet have traveled hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl, westward we rode. And your deserts were hot, and your mountains were cold. California, Arizona, make all your crops. Then up north to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from the ground, pull your grapes from the vine. To set on your table, light sparkling wine. Well, I slept on the ground in the light of your moon. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes. Wherever your crops are, I'll lend you my hand. I'll ramble all over your green growing land. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from the Grand Coulee Dam where your waters run down. Every state in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in your fight, and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we've rambled that river and I. I'll wander your valleys till the day that I die. On the edge of your cities, you'll see us, and then we come with the dust, and we're gone with the wind. Green pastures of plenty from a dry desert ground, from the Grand Coulee Dam where your waters run down. This land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Just a few months after that East Virginia blues, you can see his guitar work is getting better. He's just ramping up at an incredible pace. And it's such a gentle version, Sean Willits, isn't it? You know, it's
just... Well, that's right. I mean, this is Bob Dylan's voice as people might not expect it. You know, he wasn't just imitating Woody Guthrie, even when he's singing Woody Guthrie songs. This is the soft voice. He also records Remember Me, which is an old country and western hit, the same kind of voice. And one of the things that people have to remember about Bob Dylan is that he's got many, many voices, and always has. When he talks about, tonal control, he's very aware of that, and he uses the different voices to fit what he thinks then is what he wants to get across. So bear that in mind, actually, as we go through the next couple of hours, to listen to Bob Dylan's most important instrument in many ways is his own voice, and you have to listen to how he uses it very, very carefully.
Well, this concept or this idiotic idea that started about 1961 that Dylan can't sing. I mean, he's one of the great singers of the 20th and 21st century. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Will Friedwald, but he's the definitive jazz music scholar. His book, where he has the Encyclopedia of Jazz Singers, he saves all the way to the very end. He does a chapter on Dylan, and this is the guy who... Uh-huh. You know, has written the definitive books on Sinatra and all of those guys. And he basically says, you know, Bob's the man, you know, that Bob is an incredibly on all levels of singing, you know, hitting notes, holding notes, knowing what voice to use, telling stories. He's, you know, it's almost that he's too good and too chameleon like to settle into a groove. So, you know, it's a. And this is my ever humble opinion, but I've always bristle when people do that cliche, oh, Bob can't sing. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
You may not like the way he sings.
It's your problem, not his.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's get now to Gertie's Folk City. So 10-year-old Sean Willits missed this show. I guess you had to be back to watch Officer Joe and the Three Stooges or something.
Yeah, all of them, exactly.
Those formative years. I grew up with that same television, Sean. But this is, I think, a few days after Robert Shelton does the this is what really starts raising the hackles of all the other folkies in the village, because Bob gets the rave review of a lifetime in the New York Times, which then, as pretty much now, was the paper of record. And the review could not have been more laudatory, basically saying. Mm-hmm. And I think he got the review. He was opening up for John Lee Hooker, unless I'm mistaken.
Actually opening up for the Greenbrier Boys.
Greenbrier Boys, okay. Yeah. And Shelton catches the show, and whatever got Shelton to do the review, he just raves about Dylan. And that review goes in Dylan's wallet and I think was there for quite some time. So he's at the Folk City, and kind of, again, tee us up here, because your snapshot, you chose this stuff, so you suffered for your art. Now it's our turn. So tell us bring us into this.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's at Gertie's Folk City over on Mercer Street. It's a little bit away from the other clubs, but there it is. It is the premier folk club in the city at this point. And Dylan had tried to break in there at the beginning. The guy who ran the place was rather dubious of this young kid. He didn't seem to be even of age, but eventually gave way, and he had an opening show in April. And then here in September, as you say, this is when he gets this rave review from Bob Shelton. And it's what it not only gets upsets the other folkies, but it's going to be part of it's a series of things happen more or less at the same time when he's going to get his first record contract with, of all people, Columbia Records. But this is a few days. This is October 1st, 1961. And we wanted to give a sense of what a Bob Dylan set sounded like if you were in the club. You know, we wanted to give as much stuff from the clubs themselves as we could. And we had some extraordinary recordings from Gertie's and elsewhere in the village. And we wanted to get that across, too. I mean, Greenwich Village is kind of a character in this whole story, this whole eight CD set. But we can get into that a little bit later.
You mean Greenwich Village.
Yeah, Greenwich Village, right. And but this is, you know, him singing, again, another folk song. And Cynthia Gooding, who was we can talk about later on, was a WBAI folk song DJ, among other things, would always record him, would try to record him. And this was happening to be a Sunday night, so there was hardly anybody there. He said there were six people there, but she was going to record him anyway to play on her show on WBAI. So this is from that set, as I say, on October 1st, 1961.
Brazos River song. Brazos River is in the eastern part of Texas. There was a wealthy old farmer that lived in the county near bar. He had a loving daughter on whom I kissed my she was pretty tall and handsome, indeed so very fair. There was no girl in the county with her that could compare. I asked her if she'd be willing to let me cross over the plains. She said it would be all right, just so I'd return again. She said that she'd be true to me, till death would be unkind. We kissed, shook hands and parted. I left my girl behind. Western city boys, a town you all know well, where everyone was friendly to show me all around. Their work and money was plentiful, and the girls to me were kind. But the only girl I thought about was the girl I left behind.
was rambling around all down by the public square. The mail coach came in and I met the mail boy there. He handed me a letter, gave me to understand that the girl I left in old Texas had married another man. I turned myself around and around, not knowing what else to do. I read down a little piece further just to see if these words were true. It's drink and I throw over, card play and I resign. For the only girl I ever did love was the girl I does to you no good, kind friend, I'm sure it'll do you no harm. If you ever find a fair young maid, marry her while you can. If you ever cross over the plains, she'll marry
at least 20 people at
Gertie's
Folks.
By that time, this is the middle of the set, so maybe word got out that Dylan was playing.
And again, there's that voice control. Is that holding the note and also unearthing a song, some obscure folk song that he probably heard once or read in a book and instantly memorized it and never forgot it.
And also the phrasing. I mean, it's not just the use of the voice, but the way he phrases the lyrics is really very interesting.
And it's unique too. He's you know, a magpie. He's picking up something from here, from there, from everywhere. Well, we talked about this earlier this morning, Sean, about a couple things that make Dylan Dylan. And I brought up one physiological thing. But if you look at the guy, he's like a little bantam rooster. There's some pictures by David Garr where he's at the pool of Newport Folk Festival. I think it's 63, and he's not the most attractive guy in a bathing suit, but what you can see is he's got an enormous rib cage. He's got lung capacity that allows him to hold his breath and hold notes. It's not something he learned. It's something he was born with. And then the other thing that he's got going on is an absolute photographic memory. He inputs information and he never forgets it. It's in, it's locked in, and he's going to recall a scrap of lyric that he picked up in the library or at the Folk Center and drop it into a song on Blonde on Blonde 5 years later, you know, or Eleven Theft 50 years later. You know, I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are on, you know, just Bob, the things that make Bob, that transcend, he's a genius, but just things that he was gifted from birth.
Yeah, I mean, the photographic memory is kind of legendary. I mean, he's talked about this himself. He says, you know, he could listen to a record and he could listen to it once and he'd have it forever. But the point about his chest control, let alone his breath control or the both, that's interesting. I mean, we did talk about it this morning. It was the first I really thought about that. And I've seen those photographs of him at the Viking Motel pool and never put two and two together. So thank you. It's an interesting way to look at it.
Well, it's my one and only contribution now, the Viking pool photographs.
No. Don't give yourself credit.
Oh, I am. Are you kidding? In the world of Dylan scholarship, to have like one bit of new information?
It's more than one bit. We'll have many, many more. But the fact is that this is true about him very early, that you can hear it, that he's got this talent that most people just don't have. And he can also learn how to yodel. You'll hear that. Maybe we'll hear that later on. Better than most people can do, especially most people from Hibbing, Minnesota.
A lost art form, yodeling. And I'm a big yodel fan. The Dzurek sisters. Yeah. Don't get me going on some early early yodelers. You brought up Cynthia Gooding. And just like Chekhov's gun, you can't mention Cynthia Gooding in Act 1 and not have it go off in Act 3. So I'm going to play an excerpt here. I don't think this is on – it might be on the box set, but I might be straying.
You included some of it. Yeah,
yeah, but this is – and it's clear to me that Cynthia Gooding is totally head over heels in love with Bob Dylan. I mean, the way she talks to him, you can just see the rapture. And, of course, Bob in this lengthy interview and beautifully recorded interview is lying through his teeth. There's hardly a single thing he says that has any bearing to reality. And she's just – I think she knows that and she could care less. So – and this will segue into one of Bob's first songs, which was lifted from – is it Penny's Farm or – well, we'll talk about that when we come out. But this is WBIA Radio. Do you have anything to say before I – you know where we're going?
Yeah, she had a song – she had a show called Folk Singer's Choice. And he was this 20-year-old kid and, well, you just listen.
You said that you'd written several new songs lately.
Yeah.
You've only sung one of them. Mm. You realize that? I know I'm working you very hard for this hour of the morning, but there it is.
This really isn't a new one, but this is one of the ones you like. I wrote this one before I got this Columbia record thing, just about when I got it. I like New York. Yeah. This is just from, this is a song from one person's angle. Come, you ladies and you gentlemen, listen to my song. I sing it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. It's just a little glimpse of a story I'll tell about an East Coast city that you all know well. It's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. Oh, New York City is a friendly old town. From Washington Heights to Harlem on down, there's a mighty many people milling all around. They'll kick you when you're up and knock you when you're down. And it's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. Well, the weekend is strong and the rich and the poor, crowded together, ain't room for no more. Crowded up above and crowded down below. When someone disappears, you never even know. And it's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. It's a mighty long ways from the Golden Gate to Rockefeller Plaza on the Empire State. Mr. Rockefeller sits up as high as a bird, and old Mr. Empire never says a word. And it's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. Well, it's up in the morning trying to find a job of work. You can stand in one place till your feet begin to hurt. If you got a lot of money, you can make yourself marry. If you only got a nickel, it's a Staten Island ferry. It's hard times in the country, living down in New York town. I'll take all the smog in California, every bit of dust in the Oklahoma plains, and the dirty in the caves of the Rocky Mountain mines. It's all much cleaner than the New York kind. It's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. Mr. Hudson come a-sailing down the stream, and old Mr. Minuit paid for his dream. But your city on a one-way track, if I had my way, I'd sell it right back. And it's hard times from the country, living down in New York town. So all you newsy people that are spreading news around, you listen to my story, you listen to my song. You can stamp on my name, you can try and get the beat. When I leave New York, I'll be standing on my feet. Hard times in the country, living down in New York town.
That's a very nice song, Bob Dylan. And you've been listening to Bob Dylan playing and singing some of his songs and some of the songs that he's learned from other people. And thank you very, very much for coming down here and working so hard.
It's my pleasure to come down.
When you're rich and famous, you're going to wear the hat, too?
Oh, I'm never going to become rich and famous.
And you're never going to take off the hat, either.
No.
You old charmer, you, Bob. Yeah. So that What I noticed about that, Sean Willits, and we're sitting here, if you're just tuning in, this is a two-hour and 15-minute now deep dive into Through the Open Window, an 8-CD set that documents Bob Dylan's formative years, the years that turned Bob Dylan into Bob Dylan, transformed him into the Bob Dylan whoever he is that we know today. And Sean Willits is a Princeton professor who wrote the album, not just wrote the book, Bob Dylan in America, but wrote the album notes to this assemblage. So he knows of what he speaks. But what I love about Hard Times in New York, which isn't that a ripoff of Penny's Farm? I'm trying to think of
it. It's down on Penny's Farm.
Basically.
I wouldn't say it's a ripoff. It's a reconfiguration.
Okay, reconfiguration. I like the way that rolls off your tongue. But and then even more prominently, Talkin' New York Blues. He's already griping about New York, and in Talkin' New York Blues, it's about being ripped off in clubs and audiences not getting him. And he hasn't even, he's just starting, and he's already, his what do they call it, carapace, his shell is already hardening, and he's already cynical and griping, which you have to love it. And you wonder why the other folkies were, the David Blues and Dave Van Ronks and, the other people come, the Phil Oakses were just like, who is this guy? He's gotten everything handed to him on a platter. He's preternaturally talented, and he's already griping about being put upon, which would, of course, find its finest expression in Positively 4th Street when he dumps a massive S-word on the entire Greenwich Village folk scene. He is true to that vision. He's never swerved from that sort of cranky side.
I don't know if I think it's all that cranky. I mean, it's a mixture. When he talks about the Empire State and all of that, there's a certain wonder about the city that he never
loses.
Well,
it is Hick looking up at the big buildings. There is a bit of that.
Yeah, but there's a wonder that's his. I mean, he doesn't think himself as Hick. He thinks himself as himself. And there's more irony, I think, in this than simply a put down. And when he does Positively 4th Street, he's not putting down the city. He's putting down someone else really heavily.
Well, it's not New York, but it's putting down the scene. And, in Talkin' New York, though, critics, they have a lot of forks and knives. They got to cut something. Bob, you haven't gotten a single bad review yet. When you're already going after critics, it's like, give me a break. Shelton just vaulted your career into the stratosphere, and you're griping about critics. I just am saying, you got to. It's part of the wonderment of Bob Dylan, and I've just picked that up. But let's get in now to the Carnegie Chapter Hall. This would be November 4th of 1961. So chronologically, isn't this right in the middle of the sessions for a first record, or is it?
Around the same time. Yeah, there are only two dates for the first record. I think they're a couple of weeks later, but yeah, they're around the same time.
So to compress this, folks, to people listening, correct me, and I know you will, Sean Willits, is that Bob does a session on harmonica with Carolyn Hester, and John Hammond is producing it. John Hammond is immediately enraptured, sees whatever Bob is giving off, the talent, the charisma, the musical chops, the who the hell is this guy, and immediately signs him to Columbia Records and also has the review of Robert Shelton so he could show his bosses, oh, he's the hot new thing here, Kingston Trio, we're going to do this folky thing. So he gets into the studio to record the first record. But at the same time, he's really starting to break out of the village in Carnegie Chapter Hall. Now, I think there's thousands of people who say they were there, but in fact, there were probably what? It sold poorly to maybe 50 people who actually saw it?
53 people. That's the official number. I don't really know. This was all, the concert was put together by Israel Young, who is a major character in the whole story.
And you have a connection, a direct 11-year-old have a connection with.
Sure,
explain
right?
to her. Yeah, you got to put your cred out here, Sean.
Well, my dad owned a bookshop in Greenwich Village, which is how I came upon all of this. And it was on the corner of on the corner of 8th Street and McDougal. So he was just down the block from where all the clubs were. And in the middle of where the clubs were was this place called the Folklore Center, which Israel Young had opened up in 1957, I believe, as a kind of citadel of American folk music. And that's what it became. Dylan walks in there very early on when he comes into the city. He impresses Izzy very much, although, Izzy knows that he's kind of full of it when he's telling all his crazy stories. But he really does like, he really is taken with Bob Dylan. He has a very large diary that he kept, and we can read it. And he says he's really taken with this guy, Bob Dylan. So he sponsored this concert at Carnegie Chapter Hall, which was a small stage, you know, around Carnegie Hall, in Carnegie Hall, but not quite Carnegie Hall. And it was going to, there are others like that actually even now inside the building. But he was going to give Dylan his first show. He wasn't just going to be playing at Gertie's or playing elsewhere. It was going to be a first show, midtown, you know, 57th Street in the city. And there Dylan was. It didn't sell very well.
53 people.
In his diary. Huh?
Yeah, and poor Izzy. Didn't.
He lost money. And Izzy was in no position to lose any money. But nevertheless, he gave Bob his first concert, or he sponsored it. And, you know, I mean, Dylan, as you hear, I mean, he doesn't know how to appear as a folk singer on stage. And he kind of just strolls around a lot, and he's off mic a lot. And it's a kind of ramshackle performance. However, there's some good stuff on it. And you can see how he keeps on growing. He keeps on working very, very hard at his craft, it comes across in this concert, even though it was considered a bust, right? And I suppose, but looking back on it, there's stuff there that I think is very, very much worth listening to,
and
which is why we put it on the record. Yeah,
and I think this one isn't on the record, and I'm going off the script a little bit, but this one, if there was ever a song that demonstrates Dylan's breath control and ability to hold mm-hmm. notes longer than Caruso, it's this. And this song will also make it to the first album. So he's already recorded this for his first album, or he's about to any day.
In a boomer shack, just a little shanty by the railroad track. Freight train whistle taught me how to cry. Humming of the drivers and the lullaby. I got the freight train blue. Lordy mama, got him in a bottom of a rambling shoe. And when the whistle blows, I got to go. Mama, don't you know? Well, it looks like I'm never gonna lose a freight train blue. Well, my daddy was a brakeman and my mama, yeah, she was the only daughter of the engineer. My sweet, I love the dirty and it ain't no joke. It's a shame the way she keeps a good man broke. I got the freight train blue. Oh, Lordy, mama, got him in the bottom of my rambling shoe. Well, when the whistle blows, I got to go. Mama, don't you know? And it looks like I'm never gonna lose a freight train blue. Well, steamboat whistles never stir my soul. Airplanes and autos always leave me cold. Everything that makes me laugh for good is a wildcat whistle on a southbound train. I got the freight train blue. I got him in the bottom of my rambling shoes. And when the whistle blows, I got to go. Mama, don't you know? Well, it looks like I'm never gonna lose a freight train blues. Well, an old woman, I took up running around. I tried 100 times, stop and settle down. Every time I want a place, I want to stay. Freight train hollers and I'm on my way. I got the freight train blues. Lordy mama, got him in the bottom of my rambling shoes. And when the whistle blows, I got to go. Mama, don't you know? Well, it looks like I'm never gonna lose a freight train blue. Thank you.
I can sing twice as long as Caruso if I want to, he tells the hapless reporter in Don't Look Back. I just love that. And you can, again, I brought up earlier the novelty act, you know, like, wow, what the hell is this? It would be, I think, the question of a few of those 53 people listening to him, this 20-year-old cherubic kid doing that. You know, it's just, it's you know.
Well, and he's also singing Jimmie Rodgers, you know. And so it's again the capacity, the capaciousness of his own listening and what he's interested in. This isn't folk music of the kind we associate with the folk revival. This is, you know, very early what we'd call country western, I suppose. And we have another one of the Jimmie Rodgers songs that we do put on the record. So it's that as well. And then, you know, you're absolutely right about, you know, the novelty aspect of it, but he's also kind of poking fun at it. I mean, he's holding the note, but then he's kind of crash, you know, he's playing around. The sense of humor is something that people don't realize.
Well, the phrase the Chaplin-esque, I think Shelton uses that line. Everyone who saw Dylan back then used the phrase Chaplin-esque. He'd fuddle with mic stands. He would just do bits that were different than what everyone else was doing.
And it came across in his raps and his monologues and before the songs. You know, he doesn't talk much at all anymore, but he's in the village. And remember, in the village in this point are a lot of young comics who are also making their way.
Yeah, Woody Allen, Bill Cosby.
Woody Allen, Joan Rivers, Bill Cosby, and they're all
Nichols
there.
And May, Tom Lehrer.
And they're all there. So, you know, he is taking everything in. And if you hear his act, when you heard his act, he would be as much of a stand-up as anything else. And it was very much a part of his art in those days. And that comes across, you know, in this performance as well, because he's kind of clowning around a little bit.
Well, let's wrap the first hour off with Ramblin' Round. This was a request you made this morning. So we're going to start hour two of this now 2 hour and 3 minute deep dive into the open window of Bob Dylan, his formative years with Sean Willits, Princeton professor who wrote the album notes to the 8-CD box set. So he knows of what he speaks. But knowing of what you speak, tell us, Ramblin' Round. You picked this one.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do this for two reasons. I mean, one is this is a Woody Guthrie song. You know, people don't realize this. Dylan has never released, at least officially, him performing a Woody Guthrie song. There are some you can get tapes and stuff and bootlegs and stuff, but no, this was recorded for the first album. This is an outtake from the first album. They're not included on the first album. And in fact, it's a second take, which John Hammond thought was inferior to the first take, but we don't have the first take, so we only have this one. But I think it's a very powerful performance. And what you can hear in this version, he's not imitating Woody Guthrie by a long shot. What he's doing, he's entering a song that somebody else wrote. He's entering it and he's making it his own. And I'll just let you hear that, because it may not sound like you would imagine a Woody Guthrie jukebox would sound.
And before we launch into that, the FCC mandates that I remind you that this is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale.
Rambling around your cities, rambling around your towns. I never see a friend I know as I go rambling around, boys. As I go rambling around, my mother prayed that I might be a man of some renown. But I am just a refugee as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. My sweetheart and my family I left in my hometown. I'm out to do the best I can as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. Fruit trees, they are loaded, the limbs are bending down. I picked them all day for a dollar, boys, as I go rambling around, as I go rambling around. Sometimes the fruit gets rotten,
and it falls down on the ground. There's a hungry mouth for every peach that falls down on the ground, boys. That falls down on the ground. Sometimes I wish I could marry and settle down, but I can't save a penny as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. Cities, rambling around your towns. I never see a friend I know as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around.
Yeah, there's Woody in there, but it's Bob Dylan in there. You can definitely hear he has made Woody his own, and he's absorbed the influences, and now it's assimilated into the Borg-like hive mind of Bob Dylan's genius. Going a little too far with that analogy, but...
Well put.
I don't know what I just said, but whatever.
It's whatever it was well put.
So here we are. We're in the studio now. Bob's doing his first album. He's hooked up with Suze Rotello, an enormous influence on Dylan. Enormous. Cannot be, talk about his muse and someone who was smart enough to get out while the going was good from a relationship that was doomed in 1964. That's one of my many issues with the Dylan, the No Direction Home, was I felt Suze was underwritten and, the adoring part was there, but the woman who was smart enough to dump him part wasn't.
Suze Rotolo was a friend of mine, and I knew her, and she's an extraordinary woman. And one of the things about the movie that I most disliked was the complete mischaracterization. They didn't use her name, but still, the complete mischaracterization of a woman that is really quite extraordinary.
Exactly. Dylan got way more from her than she got from him.
That's probably right.
But anyway, let's not speak – well, I was about to say can't speak ill of the dead because we're speaking ill of Bob Dylan, who – God bless him. It's still very much with us.
Yeah. And alas, Susie's not. But still, there you are. You're right.
Well, he's in the studio now, so we're going to go into those sessions. And you picked this song very deliberately to kind of capture what's going on in the studio and what's going on with he and John Hammond. I will bring this up. It's an old, old bit of information, but maybe a few people tuning in now. And by the way, if you're tuning in for the Grateful Dead Zone, sorry, folks, this is not the Grateful Dead, but rest assured Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir would be attentively listening to this next 2 hours as they loved Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan was a huge influence on them. And they're collectively responsible for one of the worst albums in both the Grateful Dead and Bob Dylan's career. But we won't get to, I promise you we won't be playing any of that. But set up the next song, because we're now in the studio and this was something you unearthed, because outtakes from the first album, that's a pretty rare thing to dig up.
Yeah, and this isn't really an official outtake. It's a rehearsal. It's Dylan is in the studio. He doesn't really know his way around the studio, so he's not quite sure what's going on. He may not have seen the light was on. When you're recording, a red light goes on, and you can see it. He may not have noticed that because he's not quite sure what's going on.
Peas are being popped right and left.
Well, that's a big problem, which drives Hammond crazy. But meanwhile, in any case, he thinks he's rehearsing a song called Man of Constant Sorrow. And it's a song, actually one of his better known of the songs off the first album. This is probably the one that was at least one of the more popular ones that actually lived. But he's just in the studio, and John Hammond is behind the glass, and he doesn't think that anybody's capturing this. So let's listen.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
I'll say goodbye to Colorado, where I was born and partly raised. Friends say I'm a stranger, my face you'll never see no more. But there's one promise, darling, I see you on God's golden shore. Bound to ramble through ice and snow, sleet and rain. I'm bound to ride that morning railroad. Perhaps I'll die on that train. Colorado, the place that I studied from. If I'd known how bad you'd treat me, honey, I never would have come. Goodbye to Colorado, where I was born, partly raised.
What was the name of that, Bob?
Man of Constant Sorrow.
Man of Constant...
Did you get that?
I did.
Oh, did you like that one?
Sure, it's all right. Who wrote that?
I don't know who wrote that.
Has it been recorded?
Not that way.
How has it been recorded?
A different way, I guess.
Who did it?
Judy Collins did it, but not a version that like that. That's a different one. Judy Collins on Elektra.
Elektra. We'll find out from Elektra who wrote the damn thing. Then.
Okay.
Gotta love that. And of course, Dylan, I think the Judy Collins album on Elektra that he's referring to is one of the records he stole when he went back to... Remember, he was infamously caught stealing somebody's record collection and confronted? I'm willing to bet
you. Well, I think that was... she had only recorded that record a little while ago, a little bit before... he did it. She actually came to New York after him, but she got her record contract earlier. But no, the story about him stealing records is back in Minneapolis. And it was John Pancake who was very angry at Bob and apparently approached him with a bowling pin at one point. I think that's actually in the movie. They try to do a version of that. They screw it up. But, you know, there it is.
He was a scrounge. But I love the nervous Bob, the idea of Bob Dylan trying to please. Okay, Bob Dylan actually acknowledging authority and trying to please. And, of course, he and Grossman will eject Hammond from the producer's seat very quickly once Albert Grossman gets in it. So this is a very, very narrow window. And he's 20 years old, folks, 20-year-old Bob Dylan when he's recording that.
Well, and John Hammond, I mean, just, you know, John Hammond is a legend in the recording business.
Yeah,
I mean,
this is the guy recorded, you know, Count Basie, Billy Holiday,
Count Basie. Yeah, he discovered them all. And, you know, now he's his latest discovery, right? So Bob is very grateful. I mean, he said Columbia Records is, if you're lucky to get onto Folkways Records, you're lucky to get onto, you know, Stinton Records. And this is the big time, and he's in this big studio, and now – John Hammond doesn't know anything about folk music. That's very clear. We'll write to Electra and say, "You wrote the damn thing." I mean, you know, but he certainly knows his way around a recording studio. And here's Bob trying to please this guy he hopes will be his mentor.
And the thing is, Hammond, again, I think, sees the performer. He's not seeing Bob Dylan as the great songwriter who's about to write Blown in the Wind and Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and be the voice of a generation. He's looking at an incredibly charismatic 20-year-old who doesn't sound like anybody else but sounds like everybody else, who's just extraordinary. He sees that in Dylan, as we see that we hear this when you listen to this music.
It's only two songs of his own that he on that first album, so it's mostly these kinds of interpretations.
And I want to point out here for people tuning into this now 1 hour and 48-minute deep dive into Through the Open Window, we've only played one song written by Bob Dylan in an hour and 10-minute show on Bob Dylan.
It's true.
So we're going to rectify that right now. We're going to go to Bob records the first album, and then in December he goes back to Minneapolis. And my instinct is he's going to have to, because they're still paying him his allowance. And he's also coming back to show off. It's like, here, look what I can do now, people. He's he wants to show off what he's learned, and it's extraordinary what he's learned. Maybe tee up this song, too, is featured in the Dylan movie, as so many of the songs in completely the wrong place, but we won't get into that again. But it's in there.
I haven't played any Gertie's, as I remember. Yeah, well, he comes back to Minneapolis. He had been back in May. It was some question of whether he's going to stay or not in Minneapolis, even at that point. But he goes back to New York. And then he goes back out in December, and this is where, you know, there's this crossroads legend, right, where Robert Johnson learned how to play and he met the devil at the crossroads. And this is the crossroads legend about Dylan, that he comes back to Minneapolis in December of 1961, and it's as if he's been, you know, he's been touched by something, touched by greatness. Because when he left, people like John Pancake, who I just mentioned, you know, they thought he was, you know, ordinary.
Get out the bowling pin. Get out of here.
Yeah, get out of that. And also, you know, you're just a Woody Guthrie wannabe. Woody Guthrie copycat. You're no good. And there was something to that. Now he comes back, and wow, I mean, he's doing all kinds of stuff, not only with the guitar, but with the harmonica, that, you know, they could not have imagined that this kid would pick up so quickly. So, I mean, Tony Glover, the harmonica player and member of the famous group Kurt and Rain Glover, the film No Direction Home, actually points out that they just couldn't believe the transformation.
And I'll play just a little excerpt. This is out of sequence, but this is, again, Cynthia Gooding, because I just love this interview so much, and I love hearing Bob to set up this song, even though, to be very clear, this is not how the song was originally introduced. I'm going to break chronology here.
That's fine.
Tell me about the songs that you've sung, that you've written yourself, that you sing.
Oh, those are... Well, I don't claim to call them folk songs or anything. I just call them contemporary songs, I guess. You know, a lot of people paint. You know, if they got something that they want to say, you know, they paint. Or a lot of people write. Well, I just write a song, you know, same thing. So, want to hear one?
Why, yes. That's just what I had in mind, Bob Dylan. What if it made you think of that?
Let's see. What kind do you want to hear? I got a new one I wrote.
Yeah, you said you were going to play some of your new ones for me.
Yeah, I got a new one. It must be good for somebody, this is our song. I know it's good for somebody. If it ain't for me, it's good for somebody. I just talked about it. Thank you.
was young when I left home. But I've been out rambling round. And I never wrote a letter to my home. To my home. Lord, to my home. And I never wrote a letter to my home. It was just the other day, I was drinking on my pay, when I met an old friend I used to know. Said, your mother's dead and gone, baby sister's all gone wrong, and your daddy needs you home right away. I had a shirt on my back, not a penny on my name, but I can't go home, it's away, it's away. Lord, 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 and I can't go home, it's away. If you miss the train I'm on, count the days I'm gone. You will hear that whistle blow 100 miles. 100 miles, honey, baby. Lord, Lord, Lord. And you'll hear that whistle blow 100 miles. I've played on a track, more will come and whip me back on them trestles down by old Jim McKay's. When I pay the debt I owe to the commissary store, I will pawn my watch and chain and go home. Go home. Lord, Lord, Lord. I will pawn my watch and chain and go home. Used to tell them more sometimes when I see them riding blinds. Gonna make me a home out in the wind. In the wind. Lord, in the wind. Make me a home out in the wind. I don't like it in the wind. I'll go back home again, but I can't go home. This way, this way, Lord, 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 and I can't go home. This way. I was young when I left home, and I've been on a rambling round, and I never wrote a letter to my home, to my home. Lord, 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 and I never wrote a letter to my home. Thank you.
Now, Bob, you never wrote a letter to your home. You just saw your parents. Mama Zimmerman, I'm sure, fed you really well, made you brush your teeth the first time in a year, and you sound, but I digress. The great thing about Bob Dylan is he sounded, you know, completely authentic in his own awesome inauthenticity. I've always loved that song, and over to you, Sean.
These are not autobiographical, right? I mean, these are not meant to be autobiographical. I don't know that he's being inauthentic. I think he's just being himself.
But he's being authentic. What I meant by authentic and his inauthenticity, he can inhabit the character of the song. Yeah. He's like Sinatra, exactly. One of his Dylan's other idols, Frank Sinatra.
Yes.
And Sinatra recognized that in Bob Dylan when they finally hooked up in the 90s.
Yep.
That you know, Sinatra, first and foremost, was a storyteller, you know, and could inhabit the songs. And Bob has always been able to inhabit songs, and that song is an exact thing.
That's right.
Well, in this now 2 hour and 1 hour and 40 minutes, because people want this to run forever, but I don't know why I keep looking at the big clock because there's so much to cover. We're now in 1962. We've spent an hour and 20 minutes in 1961 getting Bob launched. And the next couple of things get back to Bob Dylan as novelty act, Bob Dylan as musician, and that's Bob Dylan's harmonica playing, which, again, there's still some people out there say, oh, a guy can't play the harmonica. Well, I can see how the subjective, well, he can't sing is a matter of taste, and yes, Bob Dylan's voice isn't for everyone, but to say that the guy can't play the harmonica, no, he's an absolute master of the harmonica, always was, and early in 62, we got some interesting gigs playing the harmonica. So, Sean, over to you for the first song, which from Three Kings and the Queen.
Yes. One of the things about Bob Dylan was that he was very close to the number of black singers who came into the village. Including Victoria Spivey, who was, you're going to hear in a minute. Victoria Spivey was an old 20s. A blues artist who had something of a comeback in the 60s with the folk revival. And she had a recording. She actually had a recording studio herself, but she was recorded Dylan on this. She brought together Big Joe Williams and another point was Roosevelt Sykes. These are names that are really familiar to you if you know anything about the blues. And then Lonnie Johnson as well,
The great Lonnie Johnson.
Yeah. But this is just Dylan and Big Joe Williams. And Victoria, you're going to play Wichita, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just him and Big Joe Williams. Big Joe Williams was actually a little bit older than Robert Johnson. He'd been in Mississippi. He was a great blues legend. Dylan sort of glommed on to him when he came to New York. And then Victoria Spivey ran this recording session. And even though her husband ran the firm, didn't want to have Bob Dylan. He wanted to have Sonny Boy Williamson play on the harmonica. Victoria Spivey said, no, we're going to have this white boy do it. And this is what the result was.
And that white boy put Victoria Spivey in the back of the New Morning album. If you remember, if you look in the back, there's a picture of her looking up at Bob with the same expression that Cynthia Gooding must have had. Just, who is this guy? I'm in love with him. And speaking of adoring, I have to say this is not the first time in the last year that Victoria Spivey has come up and Lonnie Johnson has come up. I had the privilege of having Maria Muldaur on for an hour.
Oh,
and
she's
fantastic. And if you haven't heard it yet, her album, which is all Victoria Spivey covers.
Yeah.
And she and I bonded because I think my line is always that Robert Johnson is the least talented of the three Johnsons. There's also Tommy Johnson and the great Lonnie Johnson. So I totally geek out on Lonnie Johnson, but let's digress. But she had a lot of great things to say about Victoria Spivey, who basically told young Maria Muldaur, the key to success, honey, is you got to strut your stuff. Maria did.
That's it.
All right. So anyway, this is
This is Big Joe Williams, but it's Bob Dylan on harp.
Little Junior, excuse me.
Little Junior.
Right. I met a gal in Kansas City. Told she never been to school. Kansas City told me that you never have been to school.
I told her about it. After you told me a lie, woman, that's why I'm singing Wichita Blues. I'm going to Wichita, boy. Whoa, I'm going to ride the rain. I'm going to ride the rain. Tell me the women in Kansas City got this place, boy, that just don't need no man. This big Joe Little Junior's glorious hop. Yeah! Some said I raised in Georgia, but I went to school with a Georgia man. Some said I raised in Georgia, but I went to school with a Georgia man. That's why I mean the Junior Sandy Wichita Blue.
Junior struts his stuff. You got to be pretty ballsy, I think it's the correct word here, to go play harmonica behind Big Joe Williams and just pull it off so well. It's a striking piece of music.
There's a story there. Yeah, I mean, Joe Williams came to the Village, and Dylan had been talking him up to the guy who ran Gertie's and did the booking at Gertie's. And Dylan would actually sit in with him at Gertie's before this recording session happened. And they had a kind of thing, Big Joe and Little Junior. I mean, that wasn't just coming out of nowhere. They were actually kind of playing that up at Gertie's. They never really formalized a group. But, you know, he had this affinity for these black artists more than almost anybody else on the Village scene. There were some others, but he really did. And it's part of the story that has to be understood.
And as we get into, again, I point out here, folks, that we're deep into this Through the Open Window. We've heard two original Bob Dylan songs. We haven't talked about anything yet. But his love of African-American music and the culture is going to influence the creation of some of Bob's greatest songs. He's going to get very, very sincerely a part of that movement, and that's going to be part of our third act here. But I have to say, one of my favorite things on this box set that you wrote the brilliant liner notes to Sean Willett's Through the Open Window, which we're doing a 1 hour and a half left special. If you've missed the first hour and a half, well, we'll be putting it up so you can listen to what you missed. And boy, have you missed a lot. Was that you dug deep into maybe my favorite Bob Dylan session and one of my favorite appearances, and a record that I used to trot out when people said, oh, Dylan doesn't know how to play the harmonica. He's not a good harmonica player. And then I would always say, well, I got two words for you, Harry Belafonte. So take it from there.
Yeah, well, Harry Belafonte was at Webster Hall, which is actually in the Village too, sort of. And he was recording a record, and the lead track was going to be Midnight Special, the old Lead Belly song. And he was supposed to have Sonny Terry was supposed to play harp, but something happened and Sonny Terry couldn't make it. So they put out an All Points Bulletin, and they said, well, this young guy, he could be good. Bob Dylan, he shows up. So here's Bob Dylan. Now, this is, again, you know, Harry Belafonte is a big star.
Movie star. Yeah. I mean, total.
A movie star originally, exactly. And then, you know, he's really made the Calypso craze, and it's been going strong. And here's Bob Dylan, who just admires the hell out of him. And he's there with these very a group of musicians that have been around together for a long time, and session musicians. You know, and this is nothing that a little white boy from Minnesota is necessarily going to run into. Well, so he's going to play harp on the lead track, Midnight Special. And, you know, some of the early takes are okay, but, you know, early takes don't quite do it. And then he hits a spot where he's really having a problem. He's hitting a rock. Something isn't working. And that's the what we wanted people to hear, because it's a very interesting interaction between him and Belafonte. And
rolling.
The producer.
Here we go. 1 second.
Midnight Special number A48, take one.
I can't get a sound.
Sorry, right. Take your time, baby. Can you take off your boots?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come on. Listen, Bob, maybe you can start with one of those...
Yeah.
You know, start off with something exciting. Take 15. Okay, they've got to feel you out. Try it once. Let's stop the tape. Just try that.
Well, I wake up in the morning, hear the ding-dong ring. You go a-marching to the table, you see the same old thing. Baby, all I want to tell you, life a fork and a pan. And if you say a thing about it, you're in trouble with a man. So let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, then you better walk or ride. You better not stagger, and you better not fight. Sheriff Benson will arrest you. He'd carry you on down. And if the jury finds you guilty, you're penitentiary bound. So let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Yeah. Yonder comes a Miss Rosie. How in the wonder did you know? How well I know her by apron and the dress she wore. An umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. And she goes to the captain and says, I'm losing my man. So let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special.
The man knows how to play harmonica. How many takes did they do to get it finally down?
I think that was, they say 15. It was 16. I'm not sure. But I think they did 18 or 19 takes. But they ended up doing not the very last one, but one, you know, that often happens. They do two extra ones just to see. It took a while.
Please pass this on to Dylan's management team, which you're a part of, is that the next bootleg session, I just want the midnight special sessions. I want a four CD set just of Bob and Harry Belafonte and Bob stomping around trying to get it right. That's my.
I mean, this was a mashup. You could sort of tell, but you know, we put together a bunch of different things and kind of put them all. So if you listen to the whole thing, the thing that's extraordinary to me is not only that Bob is very deferential, obviously, but how sweet Harry Belafonte is with him. Just really, really nice. And it comes across a little bit, but throughout the entire tape. And then the entire band. Hugh Montenegro, the producer, he's a little bit harder to please. But it gets done. It gets the job done.
But these were like, unlike Bob Dylan, these are grown-ups, you know, who know to make records people want to listen to in a whole different milieu. Mm. And let's say from the very beginning, Bob had an adversarial relationship with the recording studio. It's not a guy who was ever particularly happy to be in there. And that's partly why he's made so many unbelievably wonderful records and partly why there's so many records that, well, are not so wonderful. But that's a whole Angels Dancing on the Head of a Pin for that. Well, I feel it's about time that we start getting to at least one or two classic Bob Dylan self-penned compositions. And something that was new on this box set, and I'm here with Sean Willits, who wrote the album notes for Through the Open Window. We're doing a deep dive into the formative years of Bob Dylan. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, in case you're wondering where this program is emanating from, the People's Republic of Santa Cruz. But this party tape had an early version. Suze Rotello, his muse, and I won't say the love of his life because he certainly held the torch for Sarah and all the assorted women, but Suze certainly was the one who really stole his heart. He certainly wrote the best songs. And I see you, Blood on the Tracks, the songs that he wrote for Suze during this period when she went to Europe and he wanted her back and was missing her terribly. And this was one of those songs. So over to you for anything you picked this. And it was new to me, and I've heard a lot of Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, he's back in Minneapolis, and he's talking to his friends.
He's in Minneapolis again? I mean, he can't stay away from there.
That's one of the points, is that there's the village had outcroppings. You know, the folk bohemia had outcroppings all over the place, and one of those places was in Minneapolis, where he's with his friends, Tony Glover and others. And, you know, it means a lot. And they also tape. I mean, tape recording was a technology that was becoming much more popular in these days. And Tony Glover in particular had a tape recorder that he would lug to these parties. And so we have some very, really excellent recordings of Dylan, not in a club setting, in a party setting, when he's letting his hair down. And he's really kind of here, he's kind of confessing. He has this song, but he wants to tell the background to the song because, as you said, Eric, Susie has left for Perugia in Italy. She's going to do her art studies there, and she was supposed to come back September 1st or so. She doesn't come back till much later, and a number of Dylan's most most extraordinary love songs come right out of this period, including the one we're about to hear.
Sky would fall tomorrow. Only if the river ran dry. Only if the rainbow lost its colors. Then the ocean turned to sand. if the blind could see me singing. Then I might fall down on my knees and cry. Only if my true love was waiting. Only if I could hear her heart pounding. Only if she was lying by me. Then I might lie in my bed again.
It's not a performance. That's an open wound, you know,
and you
changed the lyrics. I'd like to then go back in time and you tell that Bob Dylan sitting at that party, you know, in a couple of years, Elvis Presley is going to cover this song on the soundtrack to Spin Out. And it's going to be one of the greatest Elvis Presley recordings of all time. And you, Bob Dylan, is going to proclaim it as such. That was the proto version of Tomorrow is a Long Time. You also have an excerpt from, I think, is this the same party where he goes back to the Guthrie well a little bit?
Which one are we talking about?
Well, the last verses of a song.
This is the same party.
Yeah.
And, there's a little rap before the one we just sang as he is confessing, you know, my girlfriend's terribly awful. But he's also showing off how much he knows about the New York scene, and you get a sense of that with the next recording.
Everybody sings a song called This Land Is Your Land. You know that song. These are from Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie sang to me these verses here, which nobody ever sings. And these are the last verses he wrote to it. So this land is your land. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw a sign saying private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. It was Sunday morning by the steeple of the relief office. I saw the people, they were starving. And I was wondering, is this land made for you and me? This land is your land, this land is my land. California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Bit of a show off there. Well, Woody, my pal Woody, I just call him the Woodster, the Woodman, taught me these. He was not unaware of who he was, what he was doing, and he wanted to make it clear, you know, about all of that.
Bob Dylan or even Bob Zimmerman has never been unaware of who he is. And it's part of why he's done it so well is that he has tremendous ambition. He knows exactly where he wants to be. And that was something that set him apart from the other folk singers. Susie talks about this in one of the movies. And it's extraordinary. He gets it.
Well, we talked about Elvis Presley. And the Peter Sellers, not Peter Sellers, Peter Sellers, but Peter Sellers, the theater director, I think talking about the other Peter Sellers, said he didn't have the talent to handle the talent. Mm-hmm. Elvis Presley didn't have the talent to handle the talent. You know, he he burned so brightly but couldn't handle it. And, you know, to some degrees, John Lennon couldn't handle, found a way to handle it, but it was tough for him. Yeah. Paul McCartney can handle the talent.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Springsteen can handle the talent. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the ultimate at handling the talent is Bob Dylan, because he's a one man, you know, he embodies, you know, the generational change of an Elvis Presley and the Beatles and everything. And he's all by himself and he's dealing with that. And that's part of the thing that I find so more, you know, give him another Nobel Prize, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, there is the moment. I mean, you know, 66 is bad. And if you see that in the film and when he's doing the 66 tour, he is not in good shape. And then he has the, you know, the motorcycle accident and so forth. So there was a point where he could have been a James Dean, but he survived that. And then he went on from there. And
but he knew to step back from the abyss. And, you know, I always I think the motorcycle accident, he was racked up, but he wasn't racked up that bad. And I think he used it as, he just realized, enough already. I can't do this.
Yes. No, I'm thinking more about the ways he was pretty strung out. And, you know, when you get that strung out, you never know what's going to happen. But he, as you say, he stepped back, he figured it out, you know, and now he's, you know, 84 years old and still going strong.
Well, what I love too, and we'll get back to our chronology here in just a second, is, you know, he has the motorcycle accident in July of 66. He rusticates, and then pretty much 3-4 months later, he's banging out I Shall Be Released, Tears of Rage, Wheels on Fire, and the Basement Tapes. Just, well, we need some cash flow here to keep the band in beers, so let's just write some songs for demos. But he's reopens the tap and pumps out all of that music. And pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Well,
is.
We're now at the if this were a jukebox musical, now we're at about to launch here. So Bob just name-checked This Land Is Your Land, you know, absolute classic song sung by many a school choir, indelible part of America, except for those missing verses. And then Bob sits down and he writes a song pretty much as good, you know, an instant classic that people hear it and go, oh, my God, where did this come from? How did you do that? And I'll just go right into, we can talk about it afterwards. But I think this is take one in the studio. He's doing his second album. And what we can talk about, Sean, before we play this is how long it took. The first album he bangs out in a couple of sessions. Mm-hmm. Freewheelin' drags on for God knows how many sessions across 2 years. I mean, they just keep...
A full year.
In a time when the Beatles record their first album in one 12-hour session. You know, what accounts for that? You know, how could he get away with waiting so long and eating up all that studio time? He must have had that's unusual for that era, that it took so long for him to come out with a second record.
Yeah, well, it tells you something about his evolution. I mean, every time he gets to the point where he thinks he's going to be releasing something, he's onto something new, and he wants to try to get that in there. And you know, it's somewhat frustrating. They thought they had the album on a couple of occasions, and then there were some censorship problems at the very end, which led to a rather dramatic change in the album at the very last minute.
Oh, four songs but, out, John Birch, and thank God they dumped that song and they made a better record.
Yeah, a much better record. You know, so censorship has its uses, but it just I mean, he was evolving very, very quickly. The making of the records in some ways couldn't keep up with what he was doing, so that's one of the reasons it took so long.
Well, just imagine though, folks, dear listeners to this, that we've already talked about Bob as this preternaturally gifted performer, you know, great harmonica player, getting way better on guitar, charismatic, New York Times loves him, et cetera, et cetera. And all the folkies are sort of, you know, who is this? Mm-hmm. And then he writes this and plays it.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years must a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? And how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? And how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Words Abraham Lincoln when he, after delivering the Gettysburg Address, it scours, you know, it still scours today. Mm-hmm. Though I have to say the best definitive version of that, as I'm sure you'll agree, was in an episode of Gomer Pyle when Gomer, a.k.a. Jim Nabors, sings it sings it to a hippie played by the late, great Rob Reiner. And trust me, it's when Rob Reiner passed away, that was the thing I put up on Facebook. That was my favorite.
This is extraordinary. We on the record, we have actually the first version of him singing that song at Gertie's when he had just written it. And there's actually a verse missing. But yes, it's funny. It's a classic, right? But at the moment, a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people thought it was, Dave Van Ronk said, "What's blowing in the wind? What is this blowing?" You know, they were used to more specific political songs, and it's precisely the ambiguity, the indeterminacy of this. It's not one of the old, you know, popular front anthems. It's very much of his time, and I mean, it was not until Peter, Paul, and Mary made a big hit out of it that anybody realized what a great song it was. But then, of course, they did.
But yeah, and it's still just the because now we're adding to the lexicon. We have, you know, demon performer can hold notes longer than Caruso, plays great harmonica, and now, oh my God, you can write too.
Yeah, you know, that was a breakthrough. Yep.
I mean, this is where the everything starts heating up to an impossible degree. Well, we'll go out. We're in 1962. We're at the Gaslight Cafe. We've just we've indulged you, dear listener. We've actually played, I think, three original Bob Dylan songs in an hour. So how about that? But we're going to go back to the a classic at the Gaslight Cafe, which is his take on Barbara Allen. And just to comment a bit on that, this, I think, was recorded by Scott Alderson, the guy who would wind up recording all those amazing tapes of the 66 tour, correct?
It's Richard Alderson.
Richard Alderson. Richard, yeah.
Yeah.
And just, again, this is just Dylan mesmerizing a crowd around the same time of freewheeling. And he would do Barbara Allen back in the 90s, you know, Never Ending Tour. He would trot this out occasionally. So the song is worn very well for him. Before we do this, the FCC would mandate that once again I identify this fine, fine radio station. And we have a special, special way of doing that. So we're going to hear a little bit of tape here. Just stand by.
KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. KSQT Prunedale, 89.7 FM and translator K208GE, Monterey, 89.5 FM.
So Sean Willens, you're a professor of history. I want you to, that was, we're going to have a quick oral quiz on all of those call letters when we come back out. Yeah, I'm afraid we're going to have to do that. Anyway, we're off to Gertie's Folk City. This is Bob Dylan from
I think it's from The Gaslight, isn't it?
Oh, The Gaslight, correct. Absolutely correct. And you're right to correct me, being a full professor of history. What are your credentials for this? Not only are you a professor of history, you wrote the album notes. And you dare to correct me?
I actually produced this record, or co-produced this record as well. So, I'm very close to
it. Okay, I'll have two words for that. You win.
Very good.
In Charlottetown, up here, there was a fair maid dwelling. And her name was known both far and near. And her name was Barbie Allen. Was in the merry month of May, the green buds they were swelling. Poor William on his deathbed lay for the love of. Sent his man down to town to the place that she was dwelling. Saying, Master, bid your company if your name is Barbara. Slowly, slowly she got up to the place where he was lying. And when she pulled the curtain back, said, young man, I believe. Yes, oh yes, I'm very sick, and I shall never get better unless I have the love of one. The love of. Day down in the tavern, you toasted all the ladies there, but you slighted Barbara Allen. Oh yes, I remember well. That day down in the tavern, I toasted all the ladies there, but I gave my heart to Barbara Allen. She looked to the east. She looked to the west. She saw his pale corpse a-coming, crying, put him down and leave him there.
so I might gaze upon him. The more she gazed, the more she moaned, until she burst out crying, saying, I beg you, come and take him away, for my heart now too is dying. Oh, Father, Father, come and dig my grave. Dig it wide and narrow, for William died for me today. I'll die for him tomorrow. They buried him in the old churchyard. They buried her beside him, and from his heart grew red, red rose, and from her heart a briar. They grew so awful high, till they could grow no higher, and was there they tied a lover's knot, the red rose and the briar. Town not far from here, there was a maid dwelling, and her name was known both far and near. And her name was
a book title in The Rose and the Briar, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, there is that. But also, you know, there's another song. I mean, 50 years later, he's going to release an album called Tempest, and there's a song on there called Scarlet Town, and it begins the same way. Now, it's a very different song, but, you know, what he was doing 50 years earlier was going to inform what he did 50 years later. And it's an extraordinary song, actually, the second one. So is this. And also a couple of things. I mean, Bob Dylan can't sing. Huh? And secondly, just note the guitar work. I mean, the guitar work has shown how hard he has worked on his musical chops over the previous year and a half.
And he's using his inside voice at the club. You know, we've heard that voice before, yeah. But it's him singing intimately. It's what he would have sung when he's wooing Suze,
yeah.
Right? But this is him being very tender and not the strident Bob that we're about to, mm-hmm. You know, that different Bob. Well, let's, mm-hmm. You know, now he's a full-on star right now. And we touched on this earlier with the Free Will and Bob Dylan, which took a year to record and was actually released and then pulled back. And this gets us to the great Ed Sullivan kerfluffle, where conventional wisdom, if you're not a Dylan, I won't say this derogatorily, a Dylan nerd like myself and maybe Sean Willens, who's joined us for this final hour now of Through the Open Window, wrote the album notes, produced the album, and we're into the real Bob Dylan is rapidly on his way to becoming Bob Dylan now. But he's booked on the number one show in America, the show everyone watched Sunday night. If you weren't watching Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, you were going to be watching Ed Sullivan, who introduced, you know, dominated the culture. So Dylan gets the booking of a lifetime. And I always wondered, of all the songs he had, of all the things he could have brought to the party, considering Peter, Paul, and Mary had Blowin' in the Wind, and he had all sorts of funny, quirky songs, that he decides to do Talking John Birch Society Blues, which has, like, lawsuits stamped all over it. And the fact is, though, and again, I'm very curious about all of this, because the chronology, first off, that Ed Sullivan was not the bad guy here. Ed was totally fine with Bob Dylan singing that song, wanted him to sing the song. It was the nervous CBS censors who didn't want him to sing the song. I mean, am I correct in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was, I mean, first of all, there was a problem with Columbia Records because Columbia Records had pulled it off of. They thought they were going to get sued too. There's a line in there where he says that the John Birch Society, which was, you know, far right wing organization in the 1960s, that they shared Hitler's views and they thought, oh boy, are we going to get sued? So they had to pull it off of freewheeling. Much to actually, in the end, to the
betterment of the record.
Betterment of the album. Yeah, made the album better.
And collectible in Grill Marcus's record collection. But we won't
get well, they've just released it again, I gather.
Yeah,
on
they
record
did. Yes, they
something.
Did.
Yeah. So there it is. But with Sullivan, yeah, he came on the – now, look, he was a star, but he wasn't that big a star yet. Ed Sullivan was the biggest thing in the world. I mean, it's where Elvis Presley, you know, his hero.
Oh, well, two words, folks, Topo Gigio, okay?
Well, there's that too. And the flying plates and all that, yes, we remember. But, you know, this was the biggest break of all possible breaks. So he shows up and he wants to sing John Birch Society Blues. And the CBS censor on TV, much like the Columbia censor on record, said, no, we can't do this. It can't happen. And Dylan was incensed and, you know, basically he left the studio. He didn't perform.
But the thing that's interesting, and this is where I wonder about the cold calculation of Bob Dylan, which there is some of, he's not completely... Talk about getting cred, because immediately the entire mm-hmm. folk community says, my God, he had the balls to walk off the Ed Sullivan show. Mm-hmm. If one was being cynical here, he didn't really want to do the Ed Sullivan show because he's always had an adversarial relationship with television. And he picked the one song that he knew would get him canned. And somewhere in the back of his mind, he said, yeah, it's not going to hurt my brand at all. Who cares? You know, who's going to buy my records watching the Ed Sullivan show anyway? You know, we don't know. I'm just throwing out that there could be an element of calculation in there.
Well, calculation or no, it certainly didn't hurt him. So, I mean, this would have destroyed the career of any other young singer. But, of course, Bob Dylan was able to, you know, it only burnished his reputation.
Look what happened to Jackie, poor Jackie Mason, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And he did something, you know, today wouldn't bat an eye. And no one's going to sue him over it, actually. But
in case you wonder, folks, if you're not living in the 60s like me and my guests, that Jackie Mason flashed the New Jersey State Bird on the Ed Sullivan show. And let's just say it did not end well for Jackie Mason.
No.
Well, let's go. We started in Town Hall. He opened the show up with Ramblin' Down Through the World. And this is deep mm-hmm. into the set. This is one of the great Dylan recordings. There was they recorded this professionally, the April 12th, 63 show, and then they would do mm-hmm. another show at Carnegie Hall, which we'll be getting into in just a few minutes, which demonstrates really how Bob's evolved. I mean, you think that this is, you know, a year, 18 months after he's hit the Village, and now he's in complete command. But this is him doing Talking John Birch Society Blues. And when you listen to this, dear listener, you tell me, did Bob Dylan really think he could get away with this on the Ed Sullivan show?
I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was going to do. The communists was coming around. They was in the air. They was on the ground. They wouldn't give me no peace. Well, I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, started walking off down the road. I'm a real John Bircher now, look out.
with Hitler's views. Although he killed 6 million Jews, it don't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's to say, like if you got a cold, take a shot of malaria. I was looking everywhere for them gold darn reds. I got up in the morning, looked under my bed. Looked in the sink behind the chair. Looked in the glove compartment of my car. Looking everywhere. I couldn't find them. I was looking in the sink and behind the chair. I was looking for them reds everywhere. I looked way up a chimney hole. Looked deep down inside my toilet bowl. I got away. I was sitting home alone and started to sweat. I figured they was in my TV set. I peeked behind the picture frame, got a shot from my feet, hit me in the brain. Them reds did it. I know they did, them hardcore ones. I quit my job so I could work all alone, and I changed my name to Sherlock Holmes. Following some clues from my detective bag, I discovered there was red stripes in the American flag. Oh, Betsy Ross. Now, Eisenhower, he's a Russian spy. Lincoln, Jefferson, and that Roosevelt guy. To my knowledge, there's just one man that's really a true American. George Lincoln Rockwell. I know for a fact he hates commies because he picketed the movie Exodus. Well, I finally started thinking straight when I run out of things to investigate. Couldn't imagine doing anything else, and now I'm home investigating myself. Hope I don't find out anything. Good God.
For you kids out there, George Lincoln Rockwell was the head of the American Nazi Party, and the movie Exodus was Otto Preminger's pot boiler. But, well, the good thing about this, Sean Willinson, as a professor of history and politics, that the idea that a far-right movement co-opting the Nazis would have some sort of sway and control by bringing up communist paranoia and calling people Marxists right and left. Thankfully, that's so far in a rearview mirror. We don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah. Well, this was a follow-up. This is maybe today is a follow-up to that. They were a follow-up on the McCarthy era, too. But, you know, Bob wasn't the only person singing songs about the John Birch Society, because there's a – if you remember, there was a song called The John Birch Society that the Chad Mitchell Trio performed. And it was much less, what should we say, hard-hitting. But nevertheless, it made fun of the John Birch Society. And I don't know if they ever performed it on Sullivan, but, you know, it was around. It was a hit. Bob was edgy, to be sure, but he wasn't the only edgy.
I'm still going to go with he didn't want to do the Ed Sullivan show because Grossman was pushing him too hard, and he came up with a one song guaranteed to get him kicked off, and he knew it wouldn't hurt his career theory.
Yeah, but
we'll
Ed,
never know.
But Ed liked it.
Well, I know he did. The point was that, you know, especially if they'd taken it off the album, he knew it was coming off the record.
Well, that may be.
Then coming on, I'm going to go on America's Mainstream Show and do the same song that even the Folky label won't put on.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
I'm just saying is, and by the way, I admire Bob more for it. Now, just a quick story.
Yeah, right.
I saw Mickey Johns do a screening in Beverly Hills of Eat the Document. Mickey Johns was the drummer on that infamous May of 66 tour that we talked about. And at one point, Mickey talks about how he was recruited into the band. And he said Bob came down to see him play with Johnny Rivers at the Troubadour in L.A. And then he gets a call, and Bob Dylan calls him and invites him to join the band. And Mickey goes on to say, well, Bob did the deal with me. I wanted more money. And Bob said, okay, I'll pay you, but you can't let the rest of the members of the band know, because then I'll have to pay them more. And that's when my hand shot up, and I said, excuse me. Bob Dylan himself did the deal and brought that up. He goes, oh, yeah, Bob, very bottom line, Bob, which I actually thought was pretty cool. It was like, okay, you know, he definitely is the son of Abe Zimmerman, hardware store runner in Hibbing, Minnesota. And Bob is looking at the bottom line, always has in his own way, hence Victoria's Secret ads and weird stuff he does. And then, of course, he does things that are completely non-commercial and doesn't give but I just point this out as what did Churchill say? A riddle wrapped in an enigma, Bob Dylan. So let's get our boy. We talked about TV. So Bob goes over to England, and this is a momentous trip. Bob gets over to England to do a BBC show where he's cast as the itinerant folk singer. And the BBC and their infinite wisdom, just like they tried to do with all the episodes of Monty Python, only rescued from the dumpster by Python themselves, erased all copies of it. But you have an excerpt from this. And this is a trip where – talk about the sponge soaking up a lot of new stuff. So you can set us up a little bit for this little excerpt.
Yeah, well, he was over in England to do a BBC. Was going to branch out, do some drama. He'd never been in drama before, maybe since grade school. But they cast him in this play called The Madhouse on Castle Street. He withdrew himself. He said, look, I can't act. I can't do this.
And so Hearts on Fire proved he was correct in that assumption.
Indeed. And then he but they cast him as you say, as this folk singer. So they gave him some songs to sing. And he sang Blown in the Wind, and he sang a couple of others. But he sang this song. Now, this song was not one of his own compositions, nor was it a traditional folk song. It had been written, the lyrics had been written by the guy who wrote the play, Evan Jones, and who was actually a white Jamaican guy. It's a long story. But at any rate, Dylan sang this, but Dylan had to provide a tune. Now, you listen to this and you realize that the lyrics are somewhat grim, even gruesome, and they're nothing compared to what Evan Jones had written. They're much, much lightened up by Bob Dylan. So in this case, instead of hitting harder, he just, you know, backed up a little bit.
And
this is called I was just saying, this is the Ballad of the Gliding Swan.
And I think this was recorded, some intrepid person like put a cassette recorder microphone up to their television set. So forgive the quality, but you got to admire whoever did this back in 1963. We salute you.
This is the Ballad of the Gliding Swan.
Tenderly William kissed his wife, and he opened her head with a butcher knife. The swan on the river went gliding by. The swan on the river went gliding by. Lady Margaret's pillow was wet with tears. Nobody's been on it in 20 years. And the swan on the river goes gliding by. The swan on the river goes gliding by. I got a sad surprise, the doctor said, a 20-pound baby without any head. And the swan on the river went looking by. The swan on the river went gliding by. Well, the preacher was yelling and showing his hope. The price was too high, so I said no. Nope. The swan on the river went laughing by. The swan on the river went gliding by. When the swan began to sing, who is so weary of everything? The swan on the river goes gliding by. The swan on the river goes gliding by.
Again, we salute you, intrepid recorder. Not bad quality.
I have to give a shout out, because the quality is only as good as it is because of my co-producer Steve Berkowitz, who is a magician. And you can even hear some of the older tapes. It's actually two tapes put together on YouTube. But what Steve did was, astonishing. He's the Merlin of producers.
It does sound great. You know,
thank God.
And again, when you think the BBC wiped that out, and then when Bob. Don't Look Back. There's a whole scene where Albert Grossman is negotiating to get Bob to do a BBC concert special.
Mm-hmm.
And Dylan records it. Epic performance. Bob at the absolute top of his game. And the BBC wipes the entire program. It's not worth saving. And it's still lost. And the audio is pretty much lost. I mean, bad qualities. But I digress. So to set the stage, so Bob is hanging out now in English folk clubs. And boy, is like Ewan McCall and some of the old school, old guard. They know immediately what a threat this guy is. They know they recognize him immediately for everything they disdain, and Bob will have none of it. Bob just does Bob. And there's a great story that Bob was being heckled in one of these folk clubs, and Bob like just ignored the guy's existence, mm-hmm. the heckler's existence. And everyone in the audience began to realize what Dylan was doing. It was this battle of wills. And finally, the drunk throws his cigarette down and stalks out of the club. It was just this great mm-hmm. moment. But yeah. Bob's hanging out with Martin Carthy.
And yes, Martin, that's the great part. And yes, Martin, that's important.
And Martin Carthy is teaching him a song called Scarborough Fair. And Paul Simon would be taught by Martin Carthy the same song. And Paul Simon, let's just say, having a very elastic relationship with publishing rights, actually coming out of the New York Carole King Brill Building, knew exactly what those rights did, changed a few things around, dropped in as a composition of his and claimed all the credit for it, something that, let's just say, Martin Carthy's forgiven Paul Simon, and Paul Simon has reached out in peace, but it still left a bad taste. So I don't know what Bob does. What Bob does is he comes back and he writes one of his classic songs that he takes the DNA from Scarborough Fair, applies it to what he's feeling about Suze Rotolo. Is that correct?
It's actually Susie Rotolo.
Susie Rotolo. Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, because I've been calling her Suze Rotolo for my entire life, so I've learned something here. But But he writes the song about, everyone thinks, Echo Hellstrom, his high school girlfriend, a girl from the North Country, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know, but this is an alternate take from the Long In Gestation Freewheelin' album. And I think, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, this is one of the four songs they put in the album after they took the four songs out. So
correct.
Think about this, folks. We lost John Birch Society and the cryptic reference to George Lincoln, Rockwell, and Exodus. And we got this instead.
If you're traveling in the North Country fire, well, the winds get heavy on the borderline. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love man. If you go in the snowflake storm, when the rivers freeze as summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling wind. See for me if a hair's hanging long, if it rolls and flows all down her breast. Please see for me if a hair's hanging long. That's the way I remember her best. Remember me
anyone who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
And this is where it really starts coming together. The finger pick, yeah. And it's about as far as he got as a finger picker. You know, he sort of abandoned mm-hmm. ship with that by times they're changing. Harmonica, impeccable. Songwriting, impeccable. Voice, impeccable. He's, I think we've achieved full Bob Dylan. Would you not agree mm-hmm. at this point?
Yeah. Well, there's going to be a bit. It shows up in slightly different ways in slightly different songs that he's writing right in this period in mid-1963. This is actually written a little bit earlier than that, but you know, 63 is an extraordinary year for his talent, performance talent, but also his songwriting. His strong, it just the string of songs is incredible.
And yeah, and in charting out new areas of you know to do, and he's also remains fully committed to the civil rights movement, March on Washington. Mm-hmm. Does one of my favorite songs with Joan Baez and on the day of the I Had a Dream speech, When the Ship Comes In, a song mm-hmm. almost never performed, by the way. It's funny, it's always been one of my favorite songs. But let's you uncovered something that, again, I, as Dylan fanatic, had never heard of before, and it was, yep, he's back in Minneapolis again in 1963 at another party. He cannot stay away. Just like ICE, it seems, Bob Dylan cannot stay away from Minneapolis.
Oh, God, no. Please, let's not go there.
But the point is, he's back in town. Yep. Well, you know, he's back in town at a party, and he trots out a brand new song. Tell us about this, because this is something, a song that wasn't in a songbook, it wasn't rumored, and here it is.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the England, the trip to England. In the trip to England, he was going to the folk clubs, but he was also hanging around with the guy who was the producer or the director, I can't remember, the director of the show he was doing, Madhouse on Castle Street. And his lover was he was married, but he had this girlfriend, was an extraordinary painter named Pauline Bodie. And she's actually come up in the world. She died tragically very young. It's a moving, terrible story. But at any rate, So Dylan is doing a lot of different things in London while he's there.
Well, he's hitting on her, if I remember correctly.
You don't really know who's hitting on who and what. I mean, this is clearly reflecting a woman that he met, and he says to his friends, "This is a woman that he met in London, and this is certainly not somebody from the folk crowd. That's for sure." Who it is, who knows? He was at a party at one point. It could have been somebody there. It could just be an amalgam. But it's a spirit, and this is a very interesting song, I think. It's a spirit which you don't see in the other songs, because in this one, he's not, very much the woman is in charge in this song, as you'll see, and he learns something from the woman. Well, I won't say more. I'll let you play it.
First I came to London town, I did not stranger I did come. I walked the streets so silently, I did not know no one. I was thinking thoughts and dreaming dreams that come when you're all alone. But most of all, I was thinking about the land I left back home. I stand down by the river Thames with the wind blowing through my hair. Stop by me, but a London girl so fair. Her eyes was blue, her face was brown, her hair was brown, her face was gentle and kind. For a second I completely forgot the land I left. Thank you.
and a-walking and a-talking all through the English air. I did not know we had reached her house till we come to the top of her stairs. As we lay around on the rug in her room, she said she was from Liverpool. We talked for hours by the inside fire about the outside world so cruel. All through our sweet conversation, she thought my ways were quite strange. But I knew there's nothing about me that she would try to change. The night passed on with a drizzling rain. It's the one thing I'm finding out. I'm walking in a rambling, I know too hard of her love. I knew nothing about. Morning, the rain had turned to snow. I looked outside her window and I knew that I must go. I didn't know how to tell her, I didn't even know if I could. But I smiled a smile, she smiled a smile I'd never seen to say she understood. I stood in the snow, strange she seemed to be. For the reason I was leaving, she knew much better than me. I gazed all up at her window, where the stormy snowflake rode. I put my hands deep in my pocket, and I walked on down the road. Town I can soon forget. Likewise, it's windy weather. Likewise, some people I met. But there's one thing that's for certain, as sure as the sun shines down, I'll never forget that Liverpool girl who lived in London.
Take that, party goers. And that, so never copyright? I mean, it's copyrighted now since you put it in the box.
We just copyrighted it. Yeah, we had to do it. The lyrics have been around in some manuscripts that, in fact, Graham Nash bought at one point. And so they've been circulated, but no one had really heard this. This was on a tape that was made by Tony Glover, again, from Colonel Ray and Glover, the great harmonica player, and a very close friend of Bob Dylan's. And he just kept the tape, and it was one that managed to elude getting bootlegged. So no one had actually heard the song until we released it back in October. It was the first time.
And tell me about that process. So did you just – where do you go to listen to this stuff? And were you just idly listening to the tape and go, whoa, what the hell is that? Or
oh, no. I mean, we knew it was there. the Tony, unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but before he died, somehow Dylan's office, Bob himself, bought the Glover tapes, and from Tony and his widow. And so we got to hear all the tapes. I mean, I listened to them, but I knew the Liverpool Gal was on there, and I knew it had never been listened to before, or I certainly, you know, very few people had heard it before. And so it was extraordinary to listen to it for the first time, amidst a lot of other very good stuff on this tape. This is the missing Glover tape, if you will. And, you know, the cut right after this is him and Bob jamming. And I, since I knew Tony somewhat as well, I was determined to have that on the record. But Liverpool Gal was, you know, in some ways is the great revelation on the whole set, because literally no one has ever heard this sung by anybody, let alone by Bob Dylan, the guy who wrote it.
You're the Lord Carnarvon walking into King Tut's tomb and seeing all the glitters.
Like that. Yeah,
Dylan,
it was amazing.
Yeah, fantastic. And there's no curse attached, though. That's the good news.
No, thank goodness. I like the song, though. I mean, you know, I like it more and more as I listen to it. It's a little long, but it's got a, as I say, it's kind of a, if you think about it, it's a kind of an version of Norwegian Wood.
Yeah.
Because it's about a one-night stand, and then he has to leave, and it's all very complicated. Well, not so complicated, but anyway, it's a song that I've come to like very much.
Yeah, well, then in a parallel universe, somehow he plays this for John Lennon. John Lennon then goes and writes Norwegian Wood, and out of spite, Bob turns around and writes fourth time around, ripping off Norwegian Wood. So
could
it's
very
like,
well be.
You know,
could
who
very
knows?
Well be.
Well, let's talk now again the evolution of Bob Dylan as performer, songwriter, the whole package. He's been marinating in English folk music. So he's gone back. He's really listening to that stuff, the structure of songs, the ballad structure, just soaking it in with that amazing magpie beaver brain of his.
Right.
And he's picked up finger-picking guitar and his vocal qualities. And all of this comes to fruition in the Times There Are Changing Sessions in 1963, the album that would come out in 1964. So this song is firmly in the English ballad tradition. It's one of these songs you listen to and you think, wow, where did he pick – what child's ballad book did he pick this one up in? But it's wholly original and, of course, in perfect Bob Dylan fashion, not on the album. It was leaked. It was definitely a staple of many a bootleg album, but didn't come out officially. I think is the bootleg series this version the first time this is actually officially out there?
I think it's on volume 1-3 of the bootleg series. I think they put it in that very first bootleg.
Right,
they,
the one that started the whole curve out here.
Yeah,
but just listen to this, folks, because you know we've done a journey here across the last 2 hours and 40 minutes. Can you believe it, Sean Willits? 2 hours
That's
and 40
amazing.
Minutes. 20 minutes left. But we've gotten Bob Dylan to this place, and now I think we can just sit back and listen to a man in complete mastery of his craft.
O'Reilly stole a stallion, but they caught him and they brought him back, and they laid him down in the jailhouse ground with an iron chain around his neck. When Riley's daughter got a message that her father was going to hang, she rode by night and came by morning with gold and silver in her hand. When the judge saw Riley's daughter, his old eyes deepened in his head, saying, "Gold will never free your father. The price, my dear, is you instead." "Oh, I'm as good as dead," cried Riley. "It's only you that he does crave, and my skin will surely crawl if he touches you at all. Get on your horse and ride away." "Oh, father, you will surely die if I don't take the chance to try and pay
pay the price and not take your advice. For that reason, I will have to stay. The gallows shadows shook the evening. In the night, hound dog bayed. In the night, the grounds was groaning. In the night, the price was paid. The next morning, she had awoken. Find that the judge had never spoken. She saw that hanging branch abandoned. She saw her father's body broken. These be seven curses on a judge so cruel that one doctor can't save him. That two healers cannot heal him, and the three eyes cannot see him. That four ears cannot hear him, that five walls cannot hide him, that six daggers cannot bury him, and that seven deaths she'll never kill him.
Our Bob has never been a big fan of judges.
And right now he's doing a whole bunch of songs about judges, right, through Hattie Carroll. But this is a song. There are antecedents. The old song Gallus Pole that Lead Belly and others did. And then there's a song called Anathea that that Judy Collins had recorded. But what Dylan managed to do here is to collapse time in an extraordinary way. I mean, this song could have been written in 1560, and yet it was written in 1963. He's very extraordinarily adept at this, and I just think it's a beautiful song in its own right. But it's almost chilling to realize the how it's moved through time and space.
And really, no one but him could have. Maybe Richard Thompson could do it. You know, yeah. There's only a few artists I could think could do that justice. Yeah. Dylan just nails it, the guitar, everything about it, just the vengeful voice. Yeah. He's at the top of his game.
Well, absolutely.
Well, you did a solid for me, because one of my favorite Dylan songs, I'd never dreamed that there was an outtake, and this I know was new on this Through the Open Window bootleg series, Volume 18. And I'm here, if you're just tuning in, boy, did you miss a good show. But I'm here with Sean Willits, professor of history at Princeton University, and far more importantly, for the sake of this particular broadcast, the co-producer and liner notes album writer for this amazing box set. But the song I'm about to play has, and Sean, you know Dylan pretty well here. Let me walk to you how this could be Dylan's most enduring, I won't say significant song, but a song that has followed him throughout his career. It was first recorded, I think this is the first version, take one, in 1963. He then plays it, remember the BBC concert, June 1st of 1965, a couple weeks before, he's probably writing Rolling Stone in the studio. He plays it in that BBC concert. He pulls it out and plays it there. And this is, you know, Don't Look Back, Bob. He then plays it with a band in 1966. He records it in the basement tapes. That was just released. He records it in the basement tapes. He records it with Johnny Cash in 1969. He records it with George Harrison in 1970. He plays it, obviously, on the 74 tour. He plays it with the Rolling Thunder. And he pretty much plays it every song since. So this is One Too Many Mornings. But think about that. I mean, this song has worn incredibly, of all the songs that Bob's done, of all the music he's put out, this song has accompanied his journey, I'm pretty sure, more than any other song that, you know, has followed all these epic periods in his career. So you can ruminate about that, Sean Willits, while we're playing it. But if you can think of a song that has that sort of every stage of his career, this song has, he can sing it. You know, it hasn't aged for him at all, which is pretty interesting. So that's the longest introduction in radio history, but here it is. Mm-hmm.
Down the street the dogs are barking and the day is getting dark. As the night comes slowly falling, the dogs will lose their bark. And the silent night will shatter from the sounds inside my mind. As I'm one too many mornings and a thousand miles behind. Crossroads on my doorstep, my eyes they start to fade, and I turn my head back to the room where my love and I bleed. And I gaze back to the street, the sidewalk and the sign, and I'm one too many mornings and a thousand miles behind. Restless, hungry feeling that don't mean no one no good. When everything I'm saying you can say it just as good. You're right from your side and I'm right from mine. We're both just one too many mornings and a thousand miles behind.
It's the perfect song. It's just perfect. You know, there's not a syllable out of whack here. And I like the fact that I think Dylan recognizes that. You know, I don't think Dylan even probably knows that he wrote it anymore. He just thinks it's a great song and plays it a lot. But
It's one of his moving on breakup songs, but it's beyond all that. It's in form as well as everything else. It's a painterly song in many ways. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right is one version of this song. This is the second version of that song, I think. And I loved that first one, but the second one just blows me away. And you're right. I mean, when he's at Albert Hall, you know, it used to go like this. It used to go like that. Now it goes like this. This is the song that he's doing. And it's extraordinary.
And it's worn well, and the version with Johnny Cash is great, you know, and the version with George Harrison and the Basement Tapes version, they all, it just has endured, and he's done it.
I wonder when the last time he's played it is. You something you could check on, you know, Bill Pagel's side or something.
I'm sure,
you know.
But again, the great news, that one of the few constructive things about the internet is that folks like us can, like, go to Bill Pagel's website and find out. Bill Pagel being the man, isn't he the guy who actually bought Bob Dylan's house?
Yes,
Bob Dylan. So we're going to go to now Carnegie Hall, and this is a song that I think, Sean Willetson, you would know, and if you don't know, I'm just going to say it is, and no one's going to contradict me. So Bob and Joan Baez are a thing, and Bob spends a very productive few weeks in Carmel Valley, which I can literally look out the metaphorical windows of the studio. I can look out and see where Bob Dylan wrote a lot of amazing songs. I'm pretty sure he wrote Farewell Angelina there. I'm pretty sure he wrote, certainly tackled Love is Just a Four-Letter Word. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this because the lyrics are so reminiscent of the Big Sur coast. And this also is Bob literally saying, I'm not that Bob anymore. I'm moving on. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people would have heard this at Carnegie Hall in October of 1963 and not said, huh, geez, Bob, what's up with you these days? This doesn't sound right. But I think you know what I'm about to play. Do you have anything to add to that too lengthy introduction?
Well, it's a song that's trying to – I mean, actually, Kerouac tried to do this in Big Sur, which is also right there. But he's trying to convey convey the sounds of nature and try to enter nature. And in some ways, it's sort of weird pantheistic song about the immanence of God in nature. And, well, I'll say no more, but it is an extraordinary song.
Lay down, lay down your weary tune. Lay down the song ye strum. And rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum. Struck by the sounds before the sun, I knew the night had gone. The morning breeze like a bugle blew against the drums of dawn. Lay down your weary tune, lay down the song you strum, and rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum. The ocean wild like an organ played. The seaweeds wove its strands. The crashing waves like cymbals clash against the rocks and the sands. Lay down your weary tune, lay down. Lay down the song ye strum, and rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hold. I stood unwound beneath the skies, and clouds unbound by laws. The crying rain like a trumpet sang, and asked for no applause. Song ye strum, and rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum. The last of leaves fell from the trees and clung to a new love's breast. The branches bare like a banjo moaned to the winds that listen the best. I gazed down into the river's mirror and watched its winding strum. The water smooth ran like a hymn, and like a harp did hum. Lay down your ear.
Well, in the words of someone I'm a little bit familiar with, I think it's time for our boot heels to be wandering. But what a gorgeous song, you know.
It really is.
And wouldn't you say with that, we've now really achieved full Bobness. You know, he's doing things that no one else is doing. He's inventing an entire new language of songwriting. He's transcended all of his influences. And he's here, and that's...
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, this is... He never performed the song again in concert. It's extraordinary. One of his greatest pieces. I mean, the greatest piece, I think, from this period is probably Hattie Carroll, but that's a whole other thing. This is an extraordinary achievement, I think, in the world of folk music or whatever you want to call it. And yet, you know, it's here at Carnegie Hall, and then it's disappeared. And it's another part of the mystery of Bob Dylan.
Well, on the subject of extraordinary achievements, Sean Willits, Through the Open Window, Bootleg Series, Volume 18, the work you've done on this that allows us to tell this story that exists for all time. And this, if there's ever a physical artifact, folks, get the CD, get the 8 CD. Don't cheap out and get the 2 CD. Get the full thing because you want the book with a 125-page essay by Sean. You want to really marinate in the entire totality of the package. So this is what's called a big plug here, but it's a sincere
one.
Well,
I thank you, Eric. Really, it means a lot to me to hear that from anybody, but especially from you.
And I want to go out here. This is a little unorthodox. I'm not going to play a Bob Dylan song, Sean, and I'm going to play a song I don't think you've ever heard before. It's by – we talked about Bob going to the BBC and hanging out in England. Well, one of the folkies, probably cousins, one of the guys out there on the street in Soho was a musician named Ralph McTell.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And Ralph wrote a great song back in 72, Zimmerman Blues. And et cetera, et cetera. But I think it just came out last year. He wrote a song that reminds me of a quote from Stanley Kubrick where Stanley said something about, sometimes it's not the think of something, it's the feel of it. And this song, I think, captures so much of what we've been talking about, the milieu, Bob and that amazing cover photo with his love of his life, the cult, you know, the village, the scene, America, the Kennedy assassination. It's all wrapped up in this song. And I'm going to take the liberty of doing a 3-hour Bob Dylan special and not playing a Bob Dylan song to wrap it up. So you're booked here. I expect to have you back when the 9-CD Belafonte Sessions Bootleg Series comes out. So
it's a deal.
Great.
It's a deal.
Good. And thank you again for joining. It's been a wonderful experience. And I think at this moment in time, we started the show sort of reflecting on what's going on right now. And I think we all need this sort of – we need this in our lives right now as positive creativity from – A luminous resident of the great state of Minnesota. But anyway, I'll leave you here with Ralph McTell and have a listen. I think this brings us right back to the beginning.
February 63, the cold will chill your bones. There's a couple walking down the road, West 4th Street in June. Shoulders hunched against the cold, they walk through melting snow. She smiles for the camera, and he affected not to know. Hands deep in his pockets, his head was slightly bowed, all the studied nonchalance that the weather would allow. Her arms wrapped round him like a shawl to keep him from the cold. Love so warm can melt away what once she had. Then it faded like a kiss.
Winter came in early, landed like a fist. When Kennedy got shot in that Lincoln limousine, trenches all in blood and splintered bone, right on a TV screen. When I kissed my girl on Gower Street, how was I to know that we'd begun to drift apart as I stumbled through Soho in the unforgiving neon light? The words she couldn't speak were written in her mascara that dried upon my cheek. The world will keep on turning, young lovers drift apart. Bob and Susie's rhyming steps leave their footprints on the heart. In the jingle jangle morning, Dylan and Rotolo in a freeze-framed photograph, eternally